Hello, and welcome to Soft Spot, episode number 13. As always, I am Chelsea Hamishan, the Global Soft Foundation Director of Marketing. Today's episode was with Lieutenant Colonel Natalie Venata, who joined us from the Army Cyber Institute. So you guessed it, this episode is focused on cyber. As Lieutenant Colonel Venata says early on, we talk about the whole gamut of cyber, from maintaining cyber talent to how soft commanders should employ cyber, to resiliency in the cyber domain, to the future of the cyber threatscape. Whether you're extremely versed on the cyber threat or you're like me and you don't know a whole lot, it's a very interesting and educational conversation. So enjoy today's podcast, which features me, our COO, Megan Keeler-Pettigrew, and Lieutenant Colonel Natalie Venata.
And then if we want to break it down.
Wow.
The Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome. The Special Operations Community.
Association for Special Operations. You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot.
I think I want to start because this is an international organization, and so we have, you know, non-U.S. Partners listening to this. Maybe just start with, what is the U.S. Army Cyber Institute, where you work, what it does, where is it in the hierarchy of Army, DoD, all that?
So the Army Cyber Institute is the Army's think tank on all things cyber. So we were put together.
Yep, okay.
Absolutely a think tank. So we were put together to think 3 to 10 years in the future, to think about the challenges that the Army is going to face, which, oh, by the way, by and large, are the same challenges society is going to face, to help us start thinking through them today. So therefore, we're not as reactive in the future, but we've already taken some time and effort, some research to think through it, to at least narrow down the options of how we can solve these challenges, or at least know which pathway we should go to. So we're a very small think tank. We're about 60 people, a combination of military and civilians, combinations of differing types of degrees. We have PhDs, we have masters. We cover the whole gambit of what cyber is, right? Because cyber is everything. And so we have computer scientists, we have mechanical engineers, we have electrical engineers, we have mathematicians, we have social scientists, we have U.S. government folks, historians, we have ethicists. We have lawyers, we have human factors, we have the whole gambit of different academic disciplines, but also areas of expertise, because there is no one solution to cyber, right? There's no one technical thing or one policy thing we're going to do. It's a whole host of things to be able to succeed in the challenges in the future.
So how do the products, the results of the research that the Institute does, how is it fed back into the Army, DoD, Cyber Command? How does that work?
So a lot of the research that we do, we publish online and publish and release it to the public. And then we also filter that back up to the various organizations that originally asked the question. Because as was alluded to earlier today, public and private partnerships are what's important. The United States military, the United States government is not going to be able to solve all the challenges facing us in the future. It is going to take a whole of society of approach. And so therefore, we need to start talking about these things today and harnessing the intelligence and the expertise across the nation, and I would say across the globe, to work at these hard problems. So some problems and challenges that the ACI identifies for the Army that we're going to face, some of them we take on internally and start to do research on. Others, we find other partners that are thinking along this space, whether these are other academics in different universities around the world. These could be industry partners that are already thinking long-term in R&D. These could be other governments that have already started thinking along that way, so that we can partner on this research to be able to provide it to the whole. We don't have the time or the resources to start doubling up on things people have already started thinking about.
Sure.
The ACI is looking for who's already in this space, who's already leaning forward and thinking ahead. Okay, let's bring their ideas into the government and the military. And what is nobody thinking about? Okay, now there's time to raise awareness and start thinking about this ourselves.
How are you finding these partners and keeping them involved?
A lot of it is just by word of mouth and personal relationships. Mm-hmm. That's how a lot of this started. There were key leaders that started this organization that were well known in this domain that were able to pull the threads and give us a lot of connections starting forward. And it's also based on the quality of the work that the Army Cyber Institute has produced over the last few years that pulls other folks in. We're also trying to look at it from a grant perspective. We're always trying to evolve and grow and getting to that question of how do we recruit other and new folks into this? Well, what can we offer them? And so we're starting to look down the ideas of federally funded grants and figuring out how we can incorporate that into the business model to attract young and new talent.
We're here at the New America and Arizona State University Future Security Forum. And so I was just in the session in which you spoke on a panel. And one of the ideas you suggested, which I think thought was a great one, and I wanted you to speak a little bit about it, was about talent management. So maybe could you share that with our listeners, what your idea, suggestion was?
Talent management, I think, is a difficult thing to do in any domain in any industry, and it's complicated even more in the cyber domain because everybody wants them. Everybody wants those cybers.
Yeah,
those cyber
demand.
Those cyber
yeah.
professionals that must know it all.
They don't know what it means,
how?
But they want them.
Yeah. Exactly. So how can I recruit that talent into the United States military when I will pay nothing like what you can potentially get in industry for high caliber workforce? Mm-hmm. A military that our recruitment model is at 18, we want to recruit you and bring you in and we will show you the world and we will give you all that training and education that you need to succeed. And that looks very different if you're recruiting in someone to be an infantry soldier or a field artillery soldier. The cost for that training and that education looks very different than someone I will bring in off the street out of high school and train them to be a cyber professional. The amount of money and time we put into that, and then they're done with their first enlistment and they go off to industry. And so that process, that traditional talent management and recruitment process, doesn't work for cyber. And so instead I say, why do you have to come in at 18? What if instead you finish high school or maybe you go to college and you go into industry and you do great and amazing things and you get all this expertise and all this experience, and then you decide at the age of 35 you want to spend a little bit of time and give back to your nation. You want to take a sabbatical from your current work role, from the business you're in, and you just want to come help and serve. And so that is, I think, one way that we can bring in the talent and the expertise we need, is allow a revolving door, give you the ability to come in and out of the Army, back into business, back into academia, and back, just like it's the standard in every place else except the United States military. Why can't we figure out how to do that? And so that, in my perfect world, mm-hmm. would be something that we could figure out, is how to, if somebody wants to give back to their country, they want to serve, at the specific time, it's about finding the right person in the right place at the right time in the right work role in order to achieve mission success. And the fact that we have these standards of who we will allow in at what age, and there's an age cap, just really defeats the purpose. Maybe it makes sense from an infantry perspective. It doesn't make sense, I believe, from a cyber perspective.
Right. And one of the things you talked about in the session was about how cyber isn't separate. It shouldn't be treated as this separate mission set, that instead it should be integrated and it's either the main effort or supporting effort, and it's a tool and a toolkit. So having said that, what should a special operations commander know about cyber, and how should special operators be trained, just kind of basic level, so that they know how to integrate it, even though they might not be the experts?
Great question. If I knew the absolute answer to that, I'd be making $1 million
Come on now.
Natalie. But I would say, like, what are those level 10 skills that everyone needs to know? Like, what are those level 10 skills that everyone knows? And that's what we need to better define in the cyber domain. I would say, I believe it made total sense how the Army stood up cyber as a separate branch and with work roles. And we started small to make sure we got this right. And that was absolutely the right decision. But the narrative that resulted because of that was that somehow cyber was uber selective. And you had to be one of the cool kids. And only the smart people got in. And as we're building this force, we at times started to do cyber for cyber's sake, instead of cyber to support the mission. And we crafted this culture initially in this narrative that we were too cool for school. Like, we were the new aviators, right? Like, no one can touch us. We're just too cool.
Oh, man. And you're going to get pajama flight suits.
Right? But we were just super special. Like, we needed the rules different for us, and we needed to wear different things, and we needed to be treated differently because we're just so different. And that's not really the truth. We have to do now is change that narrative and that attitude. We are just another effect that we put in a commander's kit bag that he or she can employ to achieve mission success. So not only do we have to change our attitude amongst the cyber professionals, which they completely understand that. We have to start changing senior leaders' perspective, and I think that's where we took the biggest hit. Mm-hmm. Not from the technically minded senior leaders, but the senior leaders in the bulk of the Army. When we came on the ground with this kind of attitude starting with, it did not set us up for success. So now we need to figure out, what is that narrative? How do we change our attitude? And how can I turn around and explain to a special operations individual or an armor dude or an infantry dudette, mm-hmm. how do I explain to that commander, what is it this effect that I give? How is this different and something you can employ? And mm-hmm. when you make a decision to put a squad of infantry people or employ that mortar platoon or employ this cyber element, it's all about the effect I can employ. They don't have to know each and every piece of physics of how it works. They don't need to know each and every line of code, but I need to be able to articulate, this is the capability and this is the effect and these are the second and third order effects that come from employing this to allow that commander the ability to make the best decision to achieve mission success.
Yeah, it was like the gentleman who stood up at the end of your session today and he's like, "Hi, my name's Jim and I'm afraid of cyber." And I feel like a lot of people do kind of have that attitude. They're like, "Oh God, you know, that's scary.
This cyber thing, it's too scary. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going to happen." And so that's why we as cyber professionals need to stand up and explain it. It's the same thing I would say in the medical community. Like the medical community, that can be really scary when you're faced with a disease or you're sick and you need that medical professional to stand up and be like, "It's okay. This is what's going to happen, and this is going to be the effect, and life's going to be okay, and this is what we're going to mm-hmm. do." From a cyber perspective, we need to stand up as professionals and be like, "It's okay. You don't have to feel comfortable here. You will get to be comfortable. You don't have to know anything, but this is what I can offer you."
That reminds me about another theme that came up in the panel that you spoke about, too, and that's resilience and how we lack that here in the U.S. on the cyber perspective. What does that look like? What is resiliency in the cyber domain?
I think resiliency in the cyber domain is about all the underlying systems. It's not resiliency for cyber's sake. It's resiliency of everything else so cyber can't affect it.
Okay.
Right? So it's the resiliency of the underlying utilities that supply the power and the water and all the necessary services to a military base so that they can do force projection from it to meet the commander's end state. And when you can affect that with cyber, that's the problem. Mm-hmm. And so it is taking a look at that critical infrastructure, whether that's critical infrastructure for the nation or critical infrastructure from a military or government perspective, and figure out, how do we make that resilient? We make it resilient from physical attacks. We can make things resilient from kinetic attacks. We can make things resilient from a nuclear weapon, if that's what we thought the threat was. But now, how do we make that same really important critical infrastructure resilient from cyber and cyber attacks?
One of the other panelists said something about relationships being the key to that resiliency.
I think relationships are important. I think it starts by us stepping back and figuring out, well, what really is critical? Like, everything needs to improve its resiliency at this point. Mm-hmm. I would say everything. So where do we start?
Yeah,
Someone has to pick where we start.
Sure.
And so we need commanders, we need leaders to say, okay, everything's really important, but these actually are my top 12 things that are most important. These are the plans, these are the missions I have to be able to do at any time. And then let us start peeling back the layers of the onion to figure out what are the things, what is that infrastructure that supports that ability to execute that mission? And then taking a deep dive and looking at, well, how resilient is it from a cyber attack or from an adversary, mm-hmm. or even just failure, right? We do we do failure analysis all the time on various pieces of utility and infrastructure. This mm-hmm. is just another component we need to add to that failure analysis to make sure it is hardened or as resilient as possible.
Time for a quick interruption to talk about a Global Soft Foundation sustaining partner that is actually very apropos for this cyber discussion, Oracle. The Oracle Corporation is an American global computer technology corporation headquartered in Redwood City, California. The company primarily specializes in developing and deploying computer hardware systems and enterprise software products, particularly advanced types of data management systems. In addition to developing and building tools for database development and systems of middle-tier software, Oracle supports the DoD and intelligence community with unique IT, analytic, cybersecurity, and data management solutions. Oracle National Security Group is a standalone business unit in Oracle, directly supporting classified client needs. The National Security Group has adapted, patented, and deployed unique capabilities for members of the IC and DoD, including the only PL4 certified multi-domain single database in U.S. industry. Thank you, Oracle, for being an awesome partner. Now let's get back to the podcast.
Are there any emerging technologies, tools, capabilities that you're excited about that have a potential to be game changers?
Anything cool on the horizon?
Yeah. Cool on the horizon.
Yeah.
I actually think what's going to be more interesting in the next 5 to 10 years is not anything new, but how we reuse and completely repurpose what is currently out there. So, for instance, blockchain, right? Blockchain for a while was the coolest thing on the street. Like, this was cool.
A lot of people said blockchain.
Yeah. Who's going to, like, revolutionize the world? Yeah. Like, blockchain. Like, put all your money
there. I don't
fully
know what they meant, but they said it.
Exactly. And, right, and so for me, from my perspective, the math behind it, like, is wicked cool. Now, mind you, the math behind it was found in, like, the 70s or the 80s, right? So, to me, blockchain's old school because it's just an application of what the math told us we could do decades ago. But it's cool. But the problem is, so we saw this first application of blockchain under this idea of cryptocurrency, which is never going to take off in this country, really. And, you know, and it gets this bad press because only criminals and other people use it, you know.
Bitcoin.
Yeah. But that's what is more interesting to me is what's the next step? What else are we going to choose to make decisions to use blockchain for? Because blockchain is a technology. Blockchain is a mathematical idea. It's really cool, and I think it can be powerful. But how are we as a society and a culture, a Western world, going to decide that we're willing to take some risk and start using it in other aspects of our life, other than this one-off idea of cryptocurrency? So I think that, amongst the various other technologies that have come out in the last couple years, I think how we as a society choose to repurpose and reuse it in comparison to how it was originally imagined by the inventors is going to be what's going to be so interesting over the next decade.
Well, that's something that's cool. What do you see as the next big like threat in terms of cyber? Or are there just too many?
One could argue there are just too many,
right?
I think we'll continue to see this hybrid threat, whether it's nation states, whether it's criminals, whether it's hacktivists. None of this is going away. It's the same threat landscape that we've had for the last decade is going to be the same threat landscape going forward. The only difference is instead of, from at least a physical perspective, from a physical threat perspective, we worry about big countries that can put together massive armies that somehow have the logistical footprint that they could invade the shores of America, right? Which we're not really worried about. Or somehow when we have troops deployed out in the open somewhere, they can come crushing in. And so these are the things we worry about. Well, from a cyber perspective, I don't need this massive million-person army, right? And so it opens the aperture a little wider than we've been used to from a Department of Defense or a military perspective that we need to start thinking about, which really only shows that we must have a whole of government approach, and I say a whole of society approach, that the only way we are going to be able to defend against this wide array of potential actors with different mission sets and different resourcing and different means of what they want to do is if we have a whole of society approach, and that is military and government and industry and academia and nonprofits and communities and even individuals all working together in order to defeat these threats and working together to make themselves and their communities and their organizations as resilient as possible. Not just from a physical resiliency, right? Because push-ups and sit-ups are always an important thing to do, but like from a mental resiliency and a cyber resiliency perspective also, because that will set us up for success in the future.
But as you said in the panel today, like even now in 2019, just across the DoD, we're not communicating and collaborating enough. So what is it going to take to, you know, finally make that start happening and eliminating these stovepipes? Do you think it's getting better or do you see the same issues?
Or is it going to take a catastrophe, unfortunately.
I do see it getting better. So that is a plus. I do see it getting better.
That's good.
I would sure hope it doesn't take a national catastrophe, because that would mean that we have failed to learn the lessons from the past. And each and every one of our history teachers should come and beat us with a ruler if we haven't learned the lessons of the past. I think what it's going to take is some outstanding leaders to help us get there. I think what empowers the workforce and organizations to change is when senior leaders stand up and said, you must communicate and you must collaborate. And that is what previous secretaries of defense and secretaries of Homeland Security did when they stood up and they said, DOD and DHS, we are going to collaborate together. We both have similar missions to defend and protect, and we must protect and defend the homeland. And so it is silly for us not to communicate and collaborate together. And so when you have the senior leaders say, you shall, all of a sudden that starts to break down some of the barriers, and it enables folks to start having the conversation. It's still scary because you still have to break down those stovepipes, but at least you know that it's okay to start having conversations and figure out what this way should be. So I would say what we need is senior leaders, and you're starting to see more and more of them understand that we really do have to start communicating and collaborating much better in this domain.
I think an interesting aspect of collaboration in this area, though, and especially when you bring in industry and non-government entities, is there's also a reluctance, or there can be, to say when perhaps you've had a cyber breach. And I think the U.S. has passed some laws to this effect that you have to disclose these things because people don't want to show their weaknesses, like that, you know, as a company, or, you know, they were hacked or whatever. But if we don't share those things, then the other organizations are vulnerable too, because they didn't learn those lessons. So that's an interesting dynamic, I think, to this particular threatscape.
Absolutely. And I think it is about changing authorities and laws in this country that will enable it. Now, mind you, I didn't go to law school and I didn't sleep at a Holiday Inn last night, but it is my understanding a lot of the reasons why we as DOD partner with DHS when we're looking at defending the homeland and defending critical infrastructure is there's some law somewhere in the books that allows companies to give DHS data about what they currently look like. Then DHS can then funnel some of that to us so that we can provide help. Whereas if that company gave it directly to DOD, that would be a FOIA-able thing. And so someone from the Freedom of Information Act could ask for their secret sauce or that thing that they wouldn't be out because it has a competitive advantage to the rest of the market, which they are allowed by law, protected communication, to share it with DHS. And thereby, we can start the negotiation of how to share that into other entities of the government. And so I think what it really does is coming down to figuring out the correct set of authorities and laws that provides a safe space for companies, for industry in the U.S. And it's absolutely set up through DHS right now, but figuring out how they can share that from a whole of government approach so that we can provide some assistance or some insights or some thoughts to be able to make them more resilient and get them the help they need prior to breach happening, prior to an attacker coming in. It is about getting left of Bang. It is absolutely awesome that, hey, when Bang hits, they call and they ask for help, and DHS is absolutely there to stand there and help them. But we've got to figure out how to make them feel comfortable and safe to share their concerns and share some information well before Bang happens, because maybe then, by working together as a whole of government, we can prevent that from even happening.
I thought Peter Singer had said interesting idea in the panel too, and he said to create a cyber equivalent of the National Transportation Safety Board, I think that's the NTSB, that after some sort of incident, cyber incident, there would be this team of that descends on the problem and figures out what went wrong without looking at liability. Of course, that would come later, as he said. But I thought that was, it just makes sense. And I wonder, because, you know, with like an airplane crash, they immediately investigate that and they want to make sure they prevent anything that can be preventable. And I wonder, is it just because we don't think of cyber attacks as costing lives that it hasn't like risen to that level yet? But I wonder, is it just a matter of time?
I look at it slightly differently. I think it's because we're not using the right words. We equate that with safety.
Yeah.
We equate that with safety, whether one person right. died or hundreds of people died. We're like, this is a safety problem. Yeah. So we're going to stop what we're going to do, and we're going to handle this because it's a safety problem. Never, for all the silly words we put after the word cyber mm-hmm. to hype people up in the mass media, you never hear cyber safety.
True.
Right? No. We hear cyber security. Yeah. We hear cyber, every wicked, dumb term you can put after cyber, mm-hmm. but we don't talk about it from a safety lens, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about the World Health Organization and why we should inoculate people from a safety perspective because we're it's the safety of humans. We look at when there are airplane crashes because we want to inculcate some safety for humans. We have to start having this conversation that cyber, we need to look at it from a safety perspective, that we're not doing this to assign blame. We're not doing this right. for other reasons. Mm-hmm. We're doing this because this is a safety problem. And if you allow this to continue, other people are going to get hurt, right? Because after a plane crashes, there's nothing you can do. Those people are injured or killed. But it's a safety perspective to make sure it doesn't happen to the next set of people. Mm-hmm. So maybe part of the conversation needs to change to look at it from a safety perspective.
Yeah, it's a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. All of these things take time. These are a lot of like cultural mm-hmm. issues. And thanks for your time. So to conclude, what is the project you're working on right now? What's your research right now about?
So right now I'm finishing up some work I'm actually doing with Arizona State University, a couple of professors, as we're looking at weaponizing AI. So we're looking far in the future. So whether you believe or not that AI is here, we're just doing advanced machine learning. At some point, AI will get here. Mm-hmm. And I like to think of it from more an anthropological standpoint. Like maybe it's young AI, it's a baby, and eventually grows up to be an adolescent, and you have to deal with all that. And then it becomes adult AI as we're going along. And so what we're looking at is as the growth and development of this AI occurs, like what are all the ways in which an adversary can weaponize it against it and change the mindset of that toddler AI so that by the time they're an adult, it's radically different. The thought processes are set. That foundation that they have set from an ethical and a moral perspective mm-hmm. is inculcated in the back of their heads, and you don't even realize it until it's too late.
Wow.
You'll have to come back and do another podcast just about that.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.